Hey everyone, it's Michelle.
And Brayden.
And this is Spooky Shit. This week we are bringing you all some creepypasta. We are serving you all some creepypasta. Get it? Get it?
Yeah.
Good. I've been awake like an hour, so that was like probably the peak of my day.
Damn. I've been awake for almost 12.
We live different lives.
A little bit.
Warning. This episode may contain graphic details. Listener discretion is advised.
Before we begin, though, how have you been?
I've been good. Just really tired. I feel like I have not really rested.
Ever in your life, honestly.
Especially lately with, like, school. Mm-hmm. But... yeah, it's just been kind of, like, nonstop since Thursday, last Thursday, like, when I last talked to you.
So it's been 8 days.
Yeah.
Ew.
Because, I ended up taking Dante to my aunt's house up in LA.
Oh, yeah, you had to drive to LA. I totally forgot about that.
And we got up there maybe around, I think it was, like, 9.
But then you had to drive home after?
It was almost 10, actually. I remember it was, like, 9:40.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up just kind of hanging out with him and making sure he was okay. And also because they just got a new puppy.
Aww.
So cute. We were like making sure, you know, like they would get along. If not, like, I don't know what we would have done, but.
If not, that would have fucking sucked.
Yeah, it would have sucked. But, you know, everything went well. And then we were like getting tired and I still had a pack. So I was like, okay, we should get going. And I think we got home close to midnight.
God damn, I'm surprised that you stayed to hang out at all. I would have been like, goodbye, we're leaving. Yeah. You figure out the dog, they better get along.
For real. Well, I mean, it was like a big favor we were asking, so I like felt bad just leaving right away. But
that's fair.
Yeah, so actually, I think I got home around like 11. But I didn't go to bed until like midnight because I like packed.
What time was your flight the next morning?
It was... at like 1 in the afternoon.
Oh, okay, cool. So you're able to like sleep and everything.
Not really.
Oh, great.
We actually left.
Naturally.
I think I woke up at like 9. Not by choice,
Why?
By alarm. Because my mom wanted to go early. Because she didn't want to ask anybody like to take us and pick us up. Because she was like... you know, it's actually kind of funny how... my mom and I, and like, we're very alike in that way. Like, if people
ask people for help,
yeah, we don't really like asking people for help or like for favors, but like, people always ask us, and like, we don't really like care. Like, we'll totally do it.
Yeah, you guys need to realize that most people also don't care. And if they care, they'll just be like, no, sorry, I can't.
True. But I don't know, it's just something about like asking. So. But yeah, she like paid for parking and everything, and it wasn't bad. And she was just, my mom definitely is not the type to ask anyone for help. Like, not even like from her own family.
Love that.
I think I'm the only person like she's okay with or like asking like me for help.
Maybe because you're the same.
Maybe, or just because, you know, I obviously live with her and I know her and I'm, like, there all the time. Versus, like, my aunts is just kind of, like, she talks to them and they know. But I don't think they really knew, like, the extent of it all.
Yeah, that's true.
As I did. I mean, I lived through it. You know what I mean?
That's, yeah, big true. You know, thinking back, you haven't asked many favors. We live fairly close to the airport. You've only asked for a ride once ever. Mm-hmm. In like 4 years. You've flown more than that.
Yeah, I have. I just feel bad.
Yeah, I don't care. If I care, then I'll just lie and be like, oh, I'm so busy. I don't mind. I'll just lie.
You're right. But yeah, so she ended up doing that and she like dropped us off because we all squished in one car because it was 6 of us.
Oh, fuck.
So we also, that's why we like woke up early too, because we just squished in her car and then she dropped most of us off. Mm-hmm. And then she went to go drop the car off and they have like a shuttle that drops them off.
Oh,
like, back at takes the airport. You to the airport. Yeah,
that's nice.
But yeah, everything went okay at the airport. Actually, well, I guess one of the, you know, the thing where you stand in there and it like scans you.
Yeah.
Well, I have noticed, you know, my voice definitely is deeper, and so they do jump to of like, oh yeah, this is a dude. So I don't know if the machine was confused or what, but yeah, they actually like stopped me, and they were like,
for a search.
Yeah, well, not like full search, but they did pull me to the side. They were like, "What's your name?" And I kind of hesitated because I'm so used to introducing myself as Brayden, and so I was like, and then I was like, "Well, obviously, I have to use my birth name because like it's on everything."
Yeah.
But it was like, you could tell, like, just funny because I totally hesitated. I like forgot my name for a second.
They're like, "Is he lying?"
Yeah. And then she's like, "Okay," because I was wearing a hat too, and so they like took my hat, and he was like feeling the brim, and then I could kind
of
tell.
That's where you keep your guns, in the brim of your hat,
right? It's a tiny ass gun.
Tiny guns, just like your microphone.
True. But yeah, I could tell because it was the guy who took my hat, and he just looked kind of confused, and then he called his, like, female coworker, and then she's the one that actually came and talked to me, and she was like, "What's your name?" And she was like, "Come here." And then she was like, "The sensor's going off around your chest." And I was like, "Okay."
From what?
I don't know. She's like, "It could be your necklace." And she's like, "You don't have anything there, or like any tenderness or whatever." I was like, "No." And then she like kind of patted me down.
And tenderness, like someone put metal in your body? I don't even know what the tenderness
would be. I don't even know. Or just like sensitivity, I guess.
You were drugged and somebody put a little bomb in your chest.
Right? But yeah, it was kind of funny. And then she was like, "Okay, you're good." She was like, "It was probably just your necklace." And I was like, "Okay."
I feel like they could just have you take off your necklace and try again. But that's right? Just me.
But yeah, that was kind of the only thing. And then, yeah, we made it to Sacramento. We got the rental car, and we got to the Airbnb, like, around the time that the rehearsal dinner was supposed to start.
Were you guys going to the rehearsal dinner?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, we, like, got to the Airbnb and just changed real quick, and then we headed
immediately over. Leave?
Yeah, we, like, immediately, like, literally just kind of dropped off our stuff, and then obviously, my mom and the girls had to do their makeup and stuff, but me and my brother just, like, got dressed, and we were, like, waiting on them. I was like,
just hanging out.
Yeah. But, yeah, it was actually really cool. It was a lot of fun, especially because I don't see my dad's side of the family that often. I feel like the last time I saw most of them was Thanksgiving last year when we went to Disneyland.
Who was it that was getting married? Like, a cousin?
Yeah, it was my cousin. It was my... Okay. Dad's sister's daughter.
Nice. Okay, cool.
But yeah, it's weird, like, to think about our relationship, because like she's always lived up in like Sacramento since a long time.
Yeah,
but like, even though we don't talk much, she's just one of those, I mean, obviously she's family, but I don't know, we just have this like pretty strong bond where we know we don't have to talk to each other, and we just have like mad love for each other.
Yeah, you're still close. The location doesn't matter.
Yeah, we're still like pretty close, even though we don't talk as much as we should. But I feel like I'm closer to her in some ways, in more ways than I am like with cousins I do see more often, you know what I mean?
You guys should have a closer bond for whatever reason.
Yeah,
it's the vibe.
It's the childhood trauma.
God damn it.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm just kidding, it's okay. Well, still, goddamn it, a little bit, but that's not, you don't have to apologize.
True. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was like at her husband's parents, like, ranch.
Oh, they like owned it?
Yeah, it was freaking huge.
Yeah.
So they had like the ceremony at the, like, in the front of the house, and we actually, she had a lot of DIY stuff. And we,
she did herself?
Mm hmm.
That's cute.
Mostly. She did have, like, her best friend, and then some other friends. Like, She got a hella good deal on, like, the cakes and stuff. She had cupcakes, and they were fucking fire, but...
Hell yeah.
She did mostly, like, everything her own and just, like, stuff that she envisioned. Like, we helped her bring it to life. Like, after we ate. After that, we just kind of helped her set up and everything. And, yeah, it turned out really great. Like, we just brought everything she wanted to life. But, yeah. And then... On Saturday was the wedding, and it was a lot of fun. We actually ended up getting up early to finish decorating, because by the time the night before, like, it just got dark, and they didn't really have a lot of lights.
Yeah, so sounds sketchy.
We couldn't see much, so we were like, okay, let's just call it, and we'll come back early, and we did. And then my mom, we had to leave, because my mom had to get her ready, my cousin.
Oh, your mom was helping, like, the bride?
Yeah, cousin? she Oh, nice. She did her hair, and then my sister did her makeup.
That's so cute.
And yeah, it was. We have a lot of videos and pictures of that.
All the behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was really fun. There was some drama, you know, as there always is. But it wasn't
every
with us.
Every family event, there's gotta be drama.
I was like, it wasn't with us, though. It was with his
none
side.
Of your business.
It was cool, though. And then the next day, we actually drove to San Francisco.
You went to San Francisco, too?
I did.
What the fuck?
Yeah, because it's only, like, an hour and a half away from
it's really not that
where
far.
We were. Yeah, it's not. It's like going here to Disney. Like, it's really not that bad. So we were like, let's go, because we've never been, and we had been wanting to.
Wait, you've never been to San Francisco?
Mm-mm.
What? How'd you like it?
It was nice. I definitely want to go back again and actually, like, take pictures at the bridge, because we didn't do that.
And, like, stay there, probably, so you can explore more. Yeah.
Or maybe, like, we could probably even stay, like, with my cousin, I feel,
and drive. Yeah, just do, like, a full day thing.
Mm-hmm. That's what we wanted to do, but we got stuck in traffic for 2 hours.
Yeah, fuck that. Yeah, we should say it's an hour and a half from around Sacramento. Very rarely when there's not traffic.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't terrible. But yeah, I wish we would have gone to the bridge first, because we actually went to, like, some pier and, like, shopping area. What's that?
I don't remember what it's called, but it's Ghirardelli's?
Yeah. We went there.
I don't know what the name of the pier is, but I've definitely been there before. It's super cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. So we did that, and then it was, like, getting dark and late, so we left, and we drove on the bridge, but it was honestly too foggy and dark. It is pretty cool, and it was actually super windy, and but it was nice. And my grandma, like, bought us all San Francisco hoodies.
Cute, I like it.
And it was funny because, well, my brother bought himself one, and then, I mean, my grandma, you know, we don't see them often, so they do try to, like, you know, spoil us in a way when we do see them,
like, make up for it
in a way. Like, yeah, they never really let us pay for anything, or, like, they're always like, here, get something, and we're like, no, it's okay. And then they're like, do it, like, get it, like, I'm,
you're like, I actually hate you to San Francisco, I really don't want to pay.
Right. But yeah, she kind of, like, in a way, not me, not really force us, but, like, is very persistent until we give in.
Insisted that you get souvenirs.
Yeah, she hella insisted. Nice. But it was funny because, like, my brother was like, as soon as he, like, saw it, he got it, and he got a yellow one. And then me and Alaris, I got like a burgundy one, and then she got a dark blue one. And then we realized, like, it corresponded with our houses for for Harry Potter.
God damn it. Of course it did.
It's funny because it was, like, not even planned. Like, we were actually taking, like, family photos, and then my brother, like, mentioned it. He's like, hey, like, our sweaters are like Harry Potter. And we were like, oh shit.
Fucking hilarious. Nerd alert.
Yeah, super big nerds. Yeah, it was cool. And then actually Monday, it kind of sucked because we got stuck at the airport basically all day.
Was your flight just, like, getting delayed?
Yeah, it got delayed, like, twice.
Ew.
Because we actually got there, I think we But yeah, like we left our hotel, checked out, and then made it because we had to drop off the rental car. So we ended up going a little earlier. Like we literally just put gas in it and went straight there. I wish we would have stopped somewhere for breakfast because like we definitely could have.
You didn't think that you'd have time, probably.
Yeah, we didn't think so. And
hindsight's 20/20.
Yeah. But yeah, I got delayed like twice. Like we were supposed to get home or over here to San Diego around like I think 3, but we didn't end up leaving Sacramento until like 3, almost 4.
Oh, I hate that.
So yeah, that was a bitch. And we were just tired and like just wanted to get home, you know?
Airports are not that fun. I'm scared to fly in a couple months.
And then I was supposed to go get Dante, my son, but I ended
up...
I ended up calling my aunt, and I was like, Dia, do you mind just keeping him one more night? Like, we're honestly super tired, and I don't want to drive.
Yeah, no, that sounds awful. Driving to LA after being at an airport all day and finally getting home.
Yeah, and then I had to work the next day. I was like, no. Nope. And she was like, yeah, of course. And yeah. But yeah, now I'm just trying to get back into the groove of things, waking up. I'm just tired. Like, I just want to sleep in, you know, but I can't.
You're so close to being done with school.
Sort of, yeah.
And then you think of how long you've been in it. You're so
not
close.
Even a year.
But how long do you have left?
Till December.
See, you're being annoying. You only have like a couple months left. You know what I mean? It's like kind of a long time.
I have like 2.5 months. Oh, shit.
You got it. And then you can just only work and you can sleep. Well, I mean, you still can't sleep in, but you can go to sleep early.
True. I can go home and nap.
Yeah, you could get another night shift job even if you want. You could do whatever your heart desires.
Maybe a night shift as a barber, but not anything else.
Yeah, no, that was shitty. Maybe an afternoon job so you could sleep in.
True. But yeah, I think that's about it going on with me. Well, because even that weekend that we were up there in Sacramento, like, we weren't sleeping because we went to sleep really late on Friday, just up talking, catching up, and then
helping, like, with wedding shit, like, you probably don't get much sleep.
Yeah, no, I think we went, it wasn't that bad. I think we went to bed maybe around, like, 1, but Saturday night, we went to bed... I think around almost 3 or 4.
What?
Yeah.
Gross.
Super gross. But it was honestly very nice conversations. And like, I just like feel like I learned a lot more about like my dad's side of the family, which is nice because I feel like we thought we knew him, but we didn't. And now I feel like in a way we're closer and they like, I don't know, it's cool though.
You get to hear their side of it.
Definitely. And then they just talked about my dad, too, and basically straight up, you know, were honest about stuff. And I was like, oh.
That's dope.
Yeah. But yeah, so how are you doing? What you been up to?
Yo, I reached actually 600 subs on Twitch now.
Damn.
Which is like a fucking flex. Obviously, that's fucking
hella
insane.
Hella flex, the fuck?
That's like 50%. We only have like 1,200 followers, so that's like half as many followers as we have. But at the same time, like, it's mostly just the same people gifting subs.
Still.
Yeah, but I'm like, I'll still take it. So technically, we only have like 50 subs. If we're talking individual people, but got some generous people. 50-ish. Because holy shit. No, it's so cool. I think I might have mentioned, I'm not sure. I'm doing another subathon next month. I'm going to do like Halloween themed. I'm doing a bunch of like cosplays and shit. So I'm super excited for that. The goal for 600, I'm going to do a Morticia Adams cosplay as well.
Ooh.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I'm like, do I have to buy a costume like her? Because like, you can only see like my shoulders up. So I'm like, I could just buy a black long sleeve shirt and like, no one would be the wiser, you know?
Just do your makeup or something.
Yeah. Black wig with red lipstick and a V-neck shirt. No one would know. I'd stand up to be like, show me your costume. I'm just wearing like pajama shorts with it. I'm like, so I didn't know. The nice part about the angle that I stream at is, like, some people stream and, like, you could see, like, most of their bodies. So they're, like, have to full on cosplay. I'm like, my bottom half just gets to be cozy.
True.
The way God intended. But, yeah. So that's so fucking cool. And we're doing another sponsorship. Back to back to back, baby. And this one is a factor. We've had it before. I'm gonna hit you up on this. Because you might like this. It's food that's already pre-prepared and you just have to heat it up. It's not even like frozen meals or anything.
Oh.
It's super nice, super easy. And they have like vegan and keto and shit. So I am personally excited because whenever... This is the second time I've had a sponsorship with them and they were so good last time that I was like, hell yeah, this is a good excuse to order more food for myself. So I'm hyped to try that. But yeah, I've just been streaming like crazy. We're going to a wedding next week for another streamer that I'm like kind of friends with from Twitch. And she's like way more popular of a streamer. I guess that her wedding's going to have like 300 people there. And like, it's kind of intimidating because I'm pretty sure some like of the bigger streamers for RuneScape are going to be there. And I'm just like, oh gosh, what if I shit my pants and they tell everyone?
Oh my God.
I was already telling Robert that. I'd have to own it. And I'd be like, yeah, that was me.
That's cool though, because maybe yeah. You can like talk to them and connections.
Yeah, make friends or find out that I really don't like them or something. Be like, oh, I'll never watch your stream.
You're done.
Yes.
I don't like you anymore.
But I'm like kind of sad because I bought a really fucking cute dress and it's like, because it's October wedding, you know, it's fall. I bought a green velvet dress that's like long sleeve and goes to like my knees and it's all super cute, very fall. It's going to be 90 degrees the day of the wedding. I'm going to have to return the shit and buy a new dress now.
Oh, shit.
There's no fucking way I could wear a velvet dress.
Yeah, no, that's...
Or I could find velvet spaghetti strip. I really want the dark green velvet. It's like the fall vibe I want to go for, but this, it sucks. It's like really nice quality too. It's from Nordstrom and... It was like $100, which was like, bleh, to be honest. But I was like, well, this is nice enough to where I could wear it to like multiple events, like if people get married. Nope. Fuck me. I'm just going to have to trade it in. Sucks.
Can I just get it like tailored? Cut off the sleeves? Yeah, just cut off the sleeves.
I don't think it would look as nice if I just cut off the sleeves. And I like the long sleeve. But I mean, I guess now I could show off my tattoos more. So that's fine. It's just, we went to like 4 stores to find this dress. Mm. I did see another, this is so, I saw at Windsor, we went to Windsor beforehand and they had, I don't know why I really like the dark green velvet. They had one like that was like spaghetti strap though and like a maxi dress. And I really wanted to try it on, but it's homecoming time. So there was like a gaggle of teenage girls in line. Like I could not. There was like at least 15 girls waiting in line to try on clothes. I was knocking in that line.
Damn.
So, I mean, maybe I'll go check Windsor again if they're finally done with their homecoming. I don't know. I don't follow anyone in high school on Instagram, so I don't know when this shit goes on. I remember, like, for a couple of years after high school, I'd always know, like, what season it was for, like, school dances because I'd follow some people who are still in it. Mm-hmm. And now I'm, like, going in blind. I don't know what time of the year it is.
Same. I was actually talking to some classmates yesterday, and we were talking about, like, high school and stuff and... Because, yeah, one of the girls is my age. Like, we're literally, like, a month apart. And
oh, nice.
Yeah, we were just talking about, like, age differences and, like, maturity levels. And we were just talking about how it's, like, interesting how, like, us older ones get along with, like, certain of them and the other ones not so much. Even though, like, the younger ones, like, are the same age. Like, there's these two girls that are 19.
Mm-hmm. One of them we fucking hate.
We don't hate her, but like we just, I don't know, we just get along more with like this other girl who's 19. Yeah,
it's just their personality.
Sort of. Or yeah. But yeah. And then I like asked this other girl, I don't know how old she is. I was like, oh, like we were talking about high school and she like told me that she went to like San Marcos and I was like, oh, I went to Mission Hills, which is in San Marcos. And nice. Then
yeah, I was like, I don't know any of the schools here. You have to
be clear. San Marcos. But yeah, it was funny because I was like, oh, when did you graduate? And she was like, last year. I was like,
a baby.
Oh, fuck. Because then it made me think about it. And then I was like, shit, like, I graduated like 7 years ago.
Isn't it funny? I was thinking about it like a couple years ago, how after high school for a few years, maybe it's also just because my anxiety was like at an all-time bad at high school age, like agoraphobic, was literally on homeschool. But I was always judged stuff by like how long ago it was based on high school. And then the farther I get away from it, because now it's been 8 years, well, 9 years, because I graduated a year early. Now I'm like, damn, high school is such a small part of your life and like low-key insignificant as fuck.
Low-key, yeah.
It feels like a big deal at the time, but now in hindsight, I'm like, yeah, no, that was nothing.
That was dumb.
It was just 4 years of dumb.
I was like, the only good thing that came out of high school was my wife.
Your wife. Only good thing that came out of high school for me, I watched a lot of shows because I was on homeschool. I graduated a year early because I was on homeschool. If I was in public school, I wouldn't have been able to cheat that hard on Google. There's no way.
You would have gotten caught.
No. I Googled all the questions. Honestly, I'd get shit wrong all the time, though. I didn't. As soon as I decided I wasn't going to college, Fs became meaningless to me, and I was not afraid of them anymore. It's a fun way of thinking. If I ever decide that I want to go to college, I don't even know if anyone will want me now. Okay, that.
There is no age limit.
True. But I'm like, eh. Maybe not. Maybe for other people. But, yeah, so we have the wedding next week, which I'm excited for. And that's hopefully it's going to be fun. A little intimidating. Oh, my God, I'm so sad. So TwitchCon's happening next weekend. Which is like, it's at the convention center. It's like Comic-Con, but like for people from Twitch. And I'm not going because I live in San Diego. So I was like, I'm going to do what you do at Comic-Con and lurk around the convention center like a little creep and see who wants to hang out with me. I already have a few people that I said I'll hang out with. I don't know when. I should have clear plans with them. But the only thing that made me want to go TwitchCon, tickets for a full weekend were $200. And then they're like, for $300, you could go for the full weekend and go to this exclusive Twitch party thing on Saturday night. And I was like, damn, I kind of want to go to this party because it's probably going to be like fun. I never go out. But it's just like, I couldn't justify spending $300. And I was like, if I really want to go out, I could just go to like a fucking bar or a club or something downtown. Mm-hmm. I'm pissed. They didn't announce the lineup. I assumed it was going to make random DJs. Megan Thee Stallion is headlining TwitchCon.
No. Your favorite.
My favorite. Like, I can't tell you. I still feel frustrated, but, like, I felt, this is going to sound so dramatic. I guess I didn't realize how much I loved Megan Thee Stallion. It felt like a hole in my heart for, like, 4 hours that day. And I was just, like, tweeting on all my different accounts, posting on Discord. I'm like, I'm so sad. Like, yeah. Oh. I didn't know. Why wouldn't they announce that? Why wouldn't they say that there was going to be such a cool performer? I thought it was just going to be like a fucking DJ from San Diego. I should have looked at past performers. But nothing would prepare me for Megan Thee Stallion. Now yeah. I'm like, she needs to just perform in San Diego for real while she's here. Or I need to sneak into this party. But I don't think that's going to be easy. Sad. I'm glad that you understand how sad this is for me. I think some people aren't understanding how sad I am about this.
I know and I'm how like, much you I'm love really her. Bummed. That's really sad.
Like every time that I stream, I figured it out now so I could play music because usually, basically if music is played in my recordings, I could get banned from Twitch for playing copyright music. So I have it like separated so people won't hear it listening back. I play Megan Thee Stallion so much every stream and like multiple times a week, I'll be like, when's she coming to San Diego? And like look it up and I'm like, she's gonna be here. I'm so sad.
Damn.
Oh well. She's gonna be in LA in December. Maybe I'll save up for that. It's just not the same.
No.
Also, there's construction going on next door, so sorry if you guys hear weird clanging noises. I've been trying to mute it when it happens. But yeah. Basically, Sag. I was also like trying to watch, this is so irrelevant, now we're doing a subject change. I was trying to watch a movie with Dutch dubbing over it last night too, and that was cool. Like, let me change something positive. Oh, I don't know if I told you, we looked into it, and because we are thinking that maybe it would be hard to move to the Netherlands, and now we're back to thinking it's kind of easy. Apparently Americans have like a friendship treaty with them, so it's like low-key easy. I just have to start my own business. So I just have to enroll Boon Babe LLC and keep like 4,500 euros in a bank account, and then that's it. I could live there.
Wow.
I just have to re-enroll every few years, but I'm like, all right, easy peasy.
Yeah, that sounds pretty
nice. Cool.
Pretty nice.
Hopefully we like it there. But yeah, watching that movie, some things in Dutch are so similar to English. It's hilarious. Like, there in Dutch, I found out last night, is there. And I'm like, I love
with
it.
With a D? Dare.
Yeah, with a D. And then there's words like please in Dutch is alsjeblieft. So I'm like, all right, you got some really English sounding. And then you're like, alsjeblieft. I thought that word was so hard whenever I first learned it. Now it's one of my favorite words that I've learned. It's spelled so weird too. There's like a J's in it and everything.
I don't think I could say it.
Alsjeblieft.
Alsjeblieft.
Oh my god, he's Dutch. Hij spreekt een beetje Nederlands. He speaks a bit of Dutch.
That's just not one word.
All you know is please, alsjeblieft.
Alsjeblieft.
It's fun. Some words don't, okay, because like there and there, I'm like, wow, that's crazy. Then where the fuck does please come from? No one knows. They just made that shit up. I like it. It's a funny language. So that's why I'm saying also, like, this is not that low-key, it wouldn't be a useful language if we didn't move to the Netherlands. So I really hope we like it there. Otherwise, I'm going to be like, well, shit, now I know this random Dutch for nothing. Pretty much, I don't have much going on. Just streaming full-time, learning Dutch, et cetera, being sad about Megan Thee Stallion. But anyway, I'm ready for some horror noodles.
All right, I shall serve you. All right, this one's not really that scary.
Well,
I liked it.
So just regular noodles.
Yeah, it's just regular noodles. It's just a little ghosty.
Okay, spooky noodles.
But yeah, it is called Dandelions. Written by Stephanie Sism. The first time I saw Brit, I was 19. I'd found a job working security at Dave's storage unit. My duties included keeping drifters and thieves from disturbing the 40 rental units that were laid out in 5 neat rows in the middle of downtown Atlanta, and helping customers with lost combinations for their locks. It wasn't the safest part of town to be working a night shift, but it seemed to be easy work, and the hours meshed nicely with my class schedule at the community college. I trained 2 shifts on days and then showed up that Thursday at 10 p.m. for my first shift alone, or so I thought. I arrived 10 minutes early. A guy in a Fallout Boy t-shirt sat at one desk playing solitaire, and a girl with a long blonde hair and her feet propped up on the other, with a ball cap pulled down covering her face. Hi, I said when he looked up. I'm Jason, the new guy. I'm Tom, he said, and started shoving stuff into a backpack. Quiet day so far. Good luck. The crazies come out at night. The girl lowered her hat and stared at me. She was the kind of beautiful that just stops a guy in his tracks. Big green eyes, full lips, flawless skin. I realized I was staring, and I mumbled hi in her direction. Her eyes widened, and she tipped her head in greeting. Tom looked up at me, eyebrows raised. Yeah, so all the keys are in the top drawer of that filing cabinet, along with the master list of combination locks. Don't give anyone access unless they show you 2 forms of ID, and you make a copy of it. They'll fire your ass if you're not a stickler about that. And it has to be the person with the name on the contract, not a girlfriend, not a wifey. Some guy almost got canned because he let a wife in and she left with this whole stamp collection in the middle of their divorce. It was him, the girl said, and pointed to Tom. He ignored her, already heading towards the door. See ya, wouldn't want to be ya, he said. Night shift sucks. The girl for the Potomac bird and I laughed. Tom shot me a look I couldn't decipher, but then he gave me a half-hearted wave and shut the door behind him. I looked at the row of monitors and then back at the girl. She hadn't taken her eyes off me, and I felt awkward and flushed under gaze. I'm Jason, I said again, and immediately felt like an idiot. Britt, she said, and she leaned back in the chair. Nice to have someone to talk to in this joint. What about Tom? I asked, sitting in the seat he vacated. She shook her head. He's a tool. So, are you second shift or third? I thought I was working alone. She shrugged. Wherever they need me. I guess they called her in to keep an eye on the new guy, and she didn't want to say she was supposed to babysit me. It was funny because she seemed standoffish at first, but then turns out she was a talker, and I loved to listen to her. By 4 a.m., it felt like I had known her forever, just one of those instant clicks, and maybe even more so by the types of conversations people tend to have at those hours. We talked everything from childhood to politics. I think I was already falling a little in love with her. She saw me stretch and said, "You want to go outside? We can do a walk around." A cool breeze blew, but she didn't seem to notice. I couldn't stop sneaking glances at her as we walked. Faded jeans, scuffed boots, black t-shirt, and a camo jacket. I probably had close to the same outfit in my closet, but on her, even the ordinary seemed beautiful. We walked the length of the first row and started down the second when she stopped and touched a bright yellow dandelion sprouting up through the crack of the sidewalk with the toe of her boot. "Those are my favorite flowers," I laughed. "Those are weeds." She smiled. "Those aren't weeds. They're wishes. Haven't you ever blown one and made a wish? And even when they're yellow, that's my favorite color. They're such happy, hopeful little things." That made me smile too. I'd never thought of them in that way. So many girls I knew seemed hung up on materialistic things, and Brett could find beauty in even this small flower. I was captivated. When we made it to the fourth row, she stopped. Her face pinched into a grim expression as she said, "I don't want to walk down this road." "Why?" I asked, taken aback by the look in her eyes. "Number 27. It gives me the creeps." It was the third bay door, and it looked exactly like the first two. I didn't understand, but I wanted her to smile again. "Then we skip this row." We finished walking the last row. A drink machine stood at the end of it, and I asked her if she wanted one. She shook her head as I fed quarters into the slot. A payphone I hadn't noticed rang shrilly, making me jump. I laughed at myself and glanced at her. Brett's expression wiped away my smile. She looked terrified. "Don't answer it," she shouted. "Don't even answer it." I gaped at her, not understanding. I won't. What's wrong?" She didn't answer. She started walking briskly back towards the office. I chased after her, my change and soft drink forgotten. "That phone rings every morning at 4:17, she said, as I opened the door for her. "When you answer, it sounds like dead air, or there's some sort of hissing noise. It gives me the creeps." "Probably some automated thing, wrong number or something, but it's set on an auto program." She looked at me and said, "Do you believe in ghosts, Jason?" "You think a ghost is calling?" "Don't make fun of me," she snapped. "I'm sorry." I held up my hands in a gesture of surrender. "Do I believe in ghosts? Well, I haven't ever seen one." She made a scoffing noise, and I said, "But I won't rule them out." My grandmother believed in ghosts. She said she had the sight and swore that some people in her family could see them. Some had the gift of precognition, too. She was very smart, reasonable lady. Mollified, Brett sat at the desk. So, do you think everyone becomes a ghost when they die? Or do they move on someplace else? Why would people be stuck here? I shrugged. Unfinished business? Violent death? I don't know. What do you think? She took a moment before responding. Maybe the unfinished business. Maybe there's just nothing else. The easy vibe of our earlier conversation disappeared. She seemed anxious, stressed. No matter what I tried to talk about, she seemed distracted. When Abe, the old guy on the first shift, appeared to relieve us, she walked out the door without saying goodbye. I bid a hasty good morning to him and ran to catch up. I almost lost her, but I spied her head as she got on the train. It had been a long time since I had a MARTA pass, so I had to dig for the 250 fare. She frowned when I sat next to her in the back, and I realized I probably looked like a creepy stalker guy. Too late now, but I didn't want her to be upset with me. I really like this girl. What are you doing? She asked, and I wanted to run, but the train lurched forward. I feel like I upset you, and I'm sorry. She looked at an elderly lady in the next row who was staring at us. Brett shook her head, like it was okay, but the lady got up and moved toward the front. It's not you, Brett said, but I don't want to talk about it. Let's talk about dandelions then, I said. They're my new favorite flower, like you. Pretty and magical.
That's a fucking simp, bro.
He is. As corny as that was, she laughed, and our conversation slid back into the same easiness it had before that payphone had rang last night. At least until the next stop. A lumbering bald man with beady dark eyes got on and took a seat a couple of rows in front of us. I saw Brett stiffen, though he didn't pay much attention to us at all. His gaze fixed on a pretty Latina who sat in the middle playing on her smartphone. The rest of the ride, Brett never took her eyes off the man. He wasn't pleasant to look at, but I didn't understand her terror. This is my stop, she said, and stood. The dark-haired girl also stood. Brett, I said, where are we? I need to get back to my motorcycle. She laughed. Then the tension evaporated from her face. You crazy boy. It will circle back around in about 6 more stops. I'll see you tonight. She waved and walked forward, giving the man a wide berth. For a moment, he looked like he was about to get behind them, and I was prepared to do so as well, so she'd feel safe, but he just sat there. Brett was already there when I arrived that night. She laughed when she saw the small bouquet of dandelions in my hand. Tom's eyebrows shot up. He opened his mouth, then closed it again. He left in record time. I don't think that guy likes me, I said. She waved her hand dismissively as I put the dandelions in water. He doesn't like anyone. And thank you for the flowers. They're lovely. So are you, I thought. But I didn't have the courage to say it. I wasn't about to bring up the guy on the train. I hated that tense, scared look she'd worn this morning. But to my surprise, she did. That man is evil, she said. Please don't ask me how to explain how I know. I'm afraid he means to hurt that girl, and I don't know how to stop him. My stomach dropped. Brett, did he hurt you? We need to call the cops. She hesitated long enough to make me think he had, but she said, no. I don't know. I can't remember things, and I'm scared to remember things. The phone makes me think of something, but I push it back. Anyway, it's not about me now. It's about that girl. She took a deep breath. Let's talk about it later. I don't want to think about it right now. I looked up dandelions between classes today, I said. People in the 1800s used to blow on them after they went to seed. If all the seeds blew away, the object of your affection shared your feelings. I shook my head and gave her a pointed look. You may not know it yet, but I think you're in love with me.
What?
She laughed long and hard, and I grinned, pleased to see her happy again. Then her face got sad. I wish I'd met you before, Jason. What's wrong with now? I asked. Uncharacteristic bravery. You're not married, are you? She shook her head. No, but I'm not what you think I am. There are a lot of bad things, Jason. I don't want to explain, because I really like you. You're a beautiful girl with a weird taste in flowers. Think of all the money I'd save on Valentine's Day if you were my girlfriend.
Okay, I also would like to point out dandelions aren't that weird of a flower.
They're cool. But
they're cool. Yeah.
She laughed again. Just keep talking to me. I hardly talk to anyone anymore. And you're so funny. Tell me about the motorcycle. I'm glad you made it back to it. I actually didn't come back to it till this morning, I admitted with a laugh. I got off the train and took an Uber to my place, then hitched a ride to school. Took the train back to work tonight. I was kind of hoping I'd see you. I had seen the creepy guy, but I didn't tell her that. Come outside and I'll show it to you. She walked around it, trailing her fingers on the gleaming blue paint. It's pretty, she said, but I don't like these things. They'll get you killed. I was hoping I could take you on a ride sometime. She gave me a glance that looked like a definite no, but said, we'll see. Everything was fine until the phone began to ring at 4:17 a.m. I watched her face get that same terrified look and wondered what in the world had happened to her, and if it was somehow connected to that creepy guy. Around time for the day shift guy to come on, she mentioned that the guy on the train again. I don't know why, but I have this feeling he's going to do something to her soon. I hate to ask, because I know you need sleep to go to class, but would you ride the train with me again? Of course, I said. Abe appeared at 6 on the dot. Good morning, sunshine, he said, dropping his backpack onto the chair. Good morning, Abe, Brett said. To me, she said, I love that old guy. I chatted with him for a moment. Brett moved to the door and I said goodbye to Abe, intent on following her when he called out, hey. His old face was pale when I glanced back. He pointed a shaky finger at the styrofoam cup filled with dandelions. Where did these come from? The look on his face spooked me. I wasn't sure what was happening. I picked them for Brett. The old man's face went slack with shock. You know Brett? You've seen her? What? I whirled to look at her. She held out her hands in supplication. Tears streamed down her face. For the first time, I noticed she had on the same outfit as she had yesterday. I'm sorry, Jason. I didn't know what to say. Jason? Abe asked, louder. I said, have you seen Brett? I couldn't tear my gaze from her. Apparently, your grandma wasn't the only one who had the gift, she said as she walked through the door. When I say walk through the door, I meant right through the door. A freaking solid metal closed door. I couldn't move, couldn't speak. Finally, I half fell onto one of the chairs. I heard Abe talking, but it was like he was speaking through a tunnel. It seemed like forever before I could focus on him. There was nothing I could say that wouldn't sound insane, so I didn't bother to sugarcoat it. I said, you didn't see her just now when you came in here? He shook his head, his rheumy eyes huge. I told him about working with her, about some of the things she said, even about the weird ringing phone. When I finished, he just stared at me. To be honest, I don't know whether to believe you right now or to call the cops, he said. I nodded. It was a fair statement. I don't know what I think in his shoes. She said you used to be a cop before your wife got sick. I looked up at him. She said you're the reason she loves dandelions. You told her about how your wife loved them and how you decorated her hospital room with them before she died. Brett said it was the most romantic thing she'd ever heard. Abe sat heavily in the chair. I did tell her that. Can I ask you to describe her for me? I did, down to her scuffed boots, and he nodded. Then he reached into a desk drawer and pulled out a picture of her. It was Brett, all right, but on a missing poster. The clothing described as the last outfit she was seen wearing was what I'd seen her in. She went missing from her shift here 6 months ago. I showed up and this place was wide open. There was a great deal of blood out by that payphone. The police never had any leads. I gestured at the row of monitors. One showed the drink machines and the phone. What about the cameras? Installed after the fact, because of her. Too little, too damn late. He leaned forward, giving me a hard stare. I loved that little girl. She was like a daughter to me. I've brought her dandelions myself. I have never believed in ghosts, but I saw your face this morning. I believe that you saw her, or you're some kind of nut that think you saw her. But I don't know how you know some of the things you know if that were the case. Brett and I worked together some time before we lost personnel and she got bumped to nights. I think she would have mentioned you, and I only told her the dandelion story right before she went missing. You could be the nut who took her, but I don't think so. I can't imagine why she'd share something like that with the person who would hurt her. If you see her again, ask her how much a mail order bride costs. What? I felt like I'd fallen back down to the rabbit hole again. Nothing made sense. I wondered if I was dreaming. Just do it, Abe said. Now go home. You look like shit. Only when I stumbled to the parking lot did I remember my promise to ride the train with her. I thought about Brett and the Latino girl. In fact, I skipped class and laid in bed and thought about them all day. When I got to work that night, Tom was the only one there. Even though I still felt punched drunk and scared, I had hoped Brett would be sitting there. Abe apparently hadn't told Tom about any of it because he treated me with the same dismissiveness as always. It was weird to look back and realize he and Brett had never actually spoken or interacted at all. I hadn't had a clue. By 4 a.m., I was getting a little stir crazy, so I jumped up to walk around the storage buildings. I turned the corner of the last one and walked straight through Brett. I screamed like a little girl. She giggled a little and clamped her hand over her mouth. I'm sorry, Jason. Are you real? I demanded. Am I crazy? I think I'm real, she said. At least, I was. I know it sounds like I'm lying, but I don't remember much. She nodded at the payphone. I remember this phone and it ringing. I think he used that to catch me off guard. I answered it and he hit me with something. I think. She pinched the bridge of her nose. I think he's about to kill that girl on the train. Maybe I'm supposed to help her. Abruptly, she swung her fist at my arm and it passed right through. I yelped. Stop doing that. Despite everything, she laughed. I was just checking. I don't know how I'm supposed to stop him when he can't even see me and I can't touch him. She winked. On the bright side, I bet you look crazy as hell on the security cameras right now. I scowled at her. Then something occurred to me. I glanced at my phone. 4:20 a.m. Hey, the phone didn't ring. She shot it a scared look. What does that mean? Are we on the right track, or are we running out of time? I had no answer. The next morning, when Abe came in, he gave me a wary look and said, "Is she here now?" I nodded and pointed at the chair she was sitting on. "Britt, how much does a mail order bride cost?" She laughed. "Tell him," I said, "ask Ernie." I told him, and his dark eyes teared up. "Britt, what happened to you?" he asked. "She doesn't remember, but we're trying to figure it out," I said. "Tell him Maggie still visits him. I've seen her around him, and she's got a little girl she calls Bumblebee with her." I told him, and he burst into tears. When he could finally speak, his voice was a gasp. "There's not a soul alive who knows that. Bumblebee was our daughter. She died back in 1974. I've never talked about her since. "Jason, the train," she said, and I told Abe we had to go. "Godspeed, son," he said. When we got on the train, the girl was already there. The bald man got on at the same stop he had previously. His attention was once again fixed on her, but hers was once again fixed on her phone. I had no weapon, and this guy was twice my size. But when I thought about him hurting Brett or this stranger, I think I could have taken him down with pure adrenaline. We were about to find out anyway, because this time when she stood, he stood too. It was still early, not a lot of folks out yet. We followed him, following her, trying to stay ducked out of sight. She paused outside a storefront and fumbled in her purse for the keys. That was the distraction he was waiting on. He charged her like a bull. It was terrifying how quickly he seized her and dragged her into an alleyway. I ran blindly into the alleyway behind him. He had her pinned against the wall, his meaty hand around her throat. "Hey," I screamed. "Hey, let her go." She still had her keys in her hand while he gaped at me. She swung at his head with a vicious arc. She missed his eye, but the key dug into his cheek. The girl gave a savage yank, opening his face. Your face.
What?
With a bellow of pure rage, he dropped her and grabbed his ruined cheek. Blood spurted between his fingers and he ran straight at me. I made a desperate lunge for his legs, but he barreled past me, straight into the pathway of a Miko's milk truck. I'd hear the sound of that impact in my head for the rest of my life. A thudding, crackling, squelching sound. But I was glad. He'd never hurt another girl again. Brett was gone. I missed her terribly, and I hoped every day she'd reappear. I realized that was selfish and that I just hoped she was at peace. There was no grave to visit, so sometimes I'd gather little bouquets of dandelions and place them at the office or at my apartment. Such happy, hopeful little things. 4 months after the incident with the Edward Culpepper, that was his name, I'd follow the story avidly in the papers. I was getting a little overtime helping Abe go through a stack of delinquent customers. "Looks like what we'll be cleaning out units 27 and 38, he said. "Non-payment of rental fees." He tossed the copies of their agreements on the desk in front of me and I froze. Edward Culpepper's face stared up at me from the photocopy of his driver's license. "Renter of unit 27. Abe noticed my face and said, "Jason, are you okay?" "That's him," I said. "That's the guy who killed Brett." I don't know why I didn't think it before then. Her strange fear of that unit. Now it made sense. I told Abe, and the old man moves out faster than I did as we grabbed the combination for that lock. It took us a while because the unit was still completely filled with old furniture and boxes of junk. But towards the back, we found a metal barrel. On the ground beside it lay Brett's army jacket. Abe grabbed my arm. "We're not opening that. We're calling the cops right now. Do you understand me?" I let him pull me outside because I didn't want to see her like that either. Brett's body was finally laid to rest, with her mother's permission and notice to the caretaker so he wouldn't try to kill them. Abe and I did some gardening work on her grave the next spring. Yellow dandelions covered it, looking as beautiful and sunny as the girl they memorialized. I think she would be pleased. 5 or 6 years passed. I graduated from college, got a real job, fell in and out of love a couple times, but I never really stopped thinking about her. Every time I saw a white dandelion, I picked it up and made a wish. When I was in the area, I visited her grave and made sure she still had her cheery little offerings. One day, I was riding my motorcycle up near Nashville, enjoying a sunny summer day. I guess the driver of the Camaro didn't see me when he swerved around a semi to change lanes. I flew through the air and fell back down, hitting the ground with a bone-jarring thud. I lay there, conscious of sounds and light, but I couldn't move at all. I couldn't feel anything either, except for the heat of the sun on my face. I was disoriented, but I guess I was in the median. Lying on the grass for sure, because there was a round white dandelion inches from my nose. Blackness seeped the edges of my peripheral vision. I couldn't blow on it, but I made my wish anyway, and then I passed out. When I came to, I still couldn't move, but I felt a little more. Specifically, I felt someone nudging my side. I looked up to see Brett prodding me with the toe of her boot. "You're just gonna lie there all day?" she asked, extending her hand. Surprisingly, my hand rose to grab hers, and it didn't pass through. She felt solid, real. I wondered if I was in the hospital, and if this was some amnesia-induced delirium. But the sun felt real enough. I even smelled burned rubber. I let her help me up, and I stood there for a moment, swaying. I saw my bike some yards away, crushed. "Ugh," I said. "Maybe I shouldn't move too much before the paramedics get here." She winced. "Yeah, about that." She pointed to the ground beside me. It was surreal to see my broken body lying there, staring sightlessly up at the sky. "Oh," I said. "Ouch."
"Oh."
She shook her head. "I told you those things would kill you." "So, now what?" I asked. "Is there a bright light we walk towards, or what?" "You're so calm. I like that about you," she shrugged. "If there's something we're supposed to be walking toward, I haven't found it yet. Maybe it's just me and you." "Maybe it's my wish," I said, as she raised an eyebrow. "I made a wish right before I passed out, died, whatever." She scrunched her nose. "Oh yeah? Is that why I'm here? What was the wish?" "Just one I've wished 1,000 times now." "You're getting really bad about responding to your ghost messages." I took her hands and made her face me. "Sorry, still getting the hang of this business." She waved her hand dismissively. "Such a rookie. But tell me, what was your wish?" "What I always wish, that I could see you again someday and do this," I said, and kissed her. I'm not sure how long we stood like that, kissing and holding each other while sirens screamed and the traffic whizzed by on the other side of the median. Eventually, we started walking. I didn't know where we were going, didn't care. All I knew was that I was with her. "So," I said, "who's Ernie, and what's this about a mail order bride?" Before she could tell me, a terrible cramp seized my body, and I felt myself being tugged backwards. Brett frowned. Her green eyes suddenly sad. "It's not your time," she said. "Stop fighting it." I didn't want to let go. I wanted to stay with her. But the tugging became a vacuum until I had no choice. I went hurtling backwards. I blinked and saw an ambulance worker standing over me. "There you are," he said as he popped up the stretcher I was somehow on. They loaded me onto the helicopter. I saw Brett standing over his shoulder. She held a dandelion in her hand. "It's okay, Jason," she said. "Some things are worth waiting for." Then she blew on the dandelion, making a wish. The end.
I'm glad he got brought back.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's depressing.
But yeah, it wasn't really that scary. It was just kind of cute.
Yeah. I mean, it was creepy at parts, the dude on the train and stuff. But I was already thinking, like, she's definitely dead, because you were like, this guy looked at him and was like raising his eyebrow, like, the fuck? I'm like, yeah, he's talking to himself. He looks crazy right now. I know it. All right. So I'm going to be reading The Big Man of Arden Street by Finn McWool. I've lived in the same house my entire life. I grew up here, and I'm raising my own family under this roof. Our home is no mansion, far from it. We live in a small terraced house on a narrow back street in North Belfast. At first glance, there isn't much to it, but I never wanted to live anywhere else. We have a community spirit that is sadly dying out elsewhere. The people on our street look out for their neighbors. We know what's happening in each other's lives, and no one members of our community need help. I'll admit, sometimes it can be stifling when all your neighbors know your business, but most of the time they show a genuine concern and a will to help. This close support network is a godsend whenever your family has fallen on hard times or suffered bereavement. And so, what binds the residents of our wee street so closely together? Well, to a large extent, it's our shared experience. Our street was first constructed in the 1880s during the rapid expansion of Belfast due to the Industrial Revolution. The original Victorian terrace houses were built to accommodate mill workers, but such jobs have since long disappeared. Over 130 years have passed, and there have obviously been significant changes in the area. Cobblestones have been replaced by tarmac, and the old houses were torn down and rebuilt from scratch during the 1980s. Nevertheless, we have so far resisted the forces of urban regeneration and gentrification, and therefore our street retains much of its original character. Some of the families have lived here for 3 or 4 generations, and the community has been through a lot during that time. World wars, troubles, and depressions, to name but a few. We've suffered and survived them all. But of course, other working class communities in Belfast and beyond have had the same experience and history. There is, however, one thing that sets our little street apart from the rest. You see, we have a unique and highly unusual tradition on our street that happens nowhere else. For almost a century and a half, we have kept this secret from the world, our people bound together in a near sacred vow of collective silence. It's with great reluctance that I'm breaking this vow after all these generations. I'm only doing so because I truly believe the time has come for people to know the truth. There's another reason, too. I have a warning that the world needs to hear. This is difficult to explain, so I think it's best to start by describing my first encounter with the big man. The year was 1987, and I was only 4 years old. My younger brother Kevin's a year behind me, so he would have been 3 at the time. Now, this wasn't the first time the big man visited our street. He comes every year on the same night, but not at the same time. Usually, he makes his appearance around midnight or in the early hours, when young children are safely tucked away in their beds. But in theory, the big man could appear at any time between dusk and dawn. In 1987, he came early, and so my parents were caught out. I remember we just had our dinner, and Kevin and I were watching some TV before bed. Looking back, I suppose my parents were tense in the evening, but you don't really pick up on things like that when you're a child. We only realized something was wrong when the street lights began to flicker, on and off 3 times in quick succession, before coming back on again. That's what happens every year. Even back in the era of gas lanterns, it was the same. We don't know what causes it, but this is the signal. This is how we know he's coming. I remember my dad going nuts when the streetlights started playing up. His eyes suddenly widened and he shot up from his armchair and screamed at me and my brother, telling us to shut that bloody TV off. Kevin and I both looked back at our father in confusion, not understanding what was going on. My father's anger grew as he clenched his fists and screwed up his face, repeating his order in a tone that left no room for doubt. Turn off the television now, or I'll slap some sense into both of you. Kevin and I looked at each other in fear before I acted quickly, switching off the TV set without delay. I remember feeling scared even at that point. My father wasn't usually an angry or violent man. Sure, he would discipline his children when necessary, but he was never nasty about it. I'd never seen him explode like this before without provocation. This was my first indication that something was very wrong. The second was when my mother flew into a blind panic, rising up from the sofa and almost pulling her hair out as she ran about the room, shouting incoherently, "It's too soon! He's come too soon! We're not ready! The kids are still up! We're not ready!" "Calm down, woman, for God's sake," my father replied firmly, as he grabbed a hold of my mother's shoulders and forced her to look him in the eye. "It's happening now, and we need to get ourselves sorted. Now get those curtains drawn and the lights off." Mum was still terrified, but she regained some level of self-composure now she had a purpose. She followed Dad's instructions by drawing the sitting room curtains, her hand shaking almost uncontrollably as she did so. Next, she switched off the main lamp, leaving the room in darkness, with only a dim light coming from the street. Daddy took a tight hold of me while Mummy held onto Kevin. His embrace was so tight that I almost couldn't breathe. "Be quiet," my dad ordered. "Don't make a single sound until I tell you it's safe. Do as I say and everything will be fine." I was petrified by this point, as was Kevin. We were both in tears, whimpering and shaking in our parents' arms. Still, we had to trust that our mom and dad would protect us from whatever danger was coming. And so, the four of us sat huddled on the floor in our darkened sitting room, waiting in fearful silence. And then we heard it. Footsteps coming from out in the street. Now, I call them footsteps, but this doesn't really do the sound justice. A Imagine a giant wearing size 20 heavy military boots, slowly but confidently marching down a pavement designed for much smaller men, with every step he takes shaking the ground and emitting a heavy thumping sound. Thump, thump, thump. I shuddered at each thud, realizing that the terrible sound was coming ever closer. Now, just to explain something about my street, none of the houses have front gardens of any description. Instead, our sitting room windows face directly out onto the street. This isn't great for privacy, as it means anyone walking on the pavement could look directly into your front room. Usually this isn't a huge problem, however, as our neighbors are respectful, and we don't get much traffic on the street. However, on that night, I soon came to a terrifying conclusion, realizing that whatever lumbering monster is making its way down the road would soon walk right past our front window, and we were powerless to stop it. Thump, thump, thump. I let out a terrified yelp as I saw a dark shadow move in front of the window. I would surely have screamed, except my father held his hand over my mouth to prevent it. We couldn't see the man as our curtains were drawn, but I recall clearly glimpsing the massive shadow of the lumbering figure, easily the largest man I've ever seen, at least 7 feet tall and broad-shouldered, with his huge figure blocking out the light. Thump. He took another step, and then suddenly, he stopped. He stood directly in front of the window and slowly turned around, shifting his huge frame so he was facing directly towards our house. All that stood between us now was the soft fabric of our curtain and a thin glass pane. We couldn't see his face or his eyes, but got the distinct impression he saw us clearly through the curtain, and I had an eerie feeling that he could see right into our very souls. Mum lost her nerve at this point. She began muttering in panic bursts, repeating, "Please God, not us, anybody but us, please God." "Shut your mouth, woman," my father muttered angrily. It wasn't like him to speak to his wife so abruptly, but under circumstances, his harsh words seemed justified. The dark figure stood outside our window for what seemed like an eternity, but in retrospect could only have been a few short seconds. And then suddenly, he lifted up his huge right hand and formed a fist, reaching out to knock against our window. Bang! The knock was so heavy that I was astonished the thin glass didn't shatter, but somehow it never does. My mother started again at this point. "Oh God. Oh God, please no, this can't be happening." I expected Dad to rebuke her again, but he said nothing. I remember looking up into his eyes and seeing pure fear. The mysterious figure knocked once and then stopped. We looked on in frozen terror, waiting helplessly to see what this monster would do next. There followed another long, intense moment before the figure slowly and calmly turned, once again facing the pavement as he continued his slow march down the street. Thump. 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 We listened cautiously, feeling the tension slowly lift the further he went. To my shame, I realized I'd wet myself, and my urine had spread all over Dad's jeans. But he said nothing about it. Instead, he was ecstatic. "One knock," he exclaimed after the figure had moved on. "One bloody knock, can you believe it?" "Thank God," Mum proclaimed emotionally. "We've been spared." "More than that," Dad answered as he got up and reached for the light switch. "We're in luck. Our numbers have come up. Damn it, I should have played the bloody pools this week," he said, laughing as he spoke. Neither Kevin nor I understood what he meant, but we felt the same relief as our parents. Clearly, as bad as it had been that night, it could have been much worse. We all slept in the same bed that night, not that any of us got much rest. The next day, we were inundated with visitors, as just about every one of our neighbors came to check on us. I remember people bringing around endless cups of tea, sandwiches, and cakes, more than we could ever eat. My parents laughed and joked at the neighbors. Min patted my dad on the back, saying what a lucky beggar he was. It was the oddest thing, and it'd be years before I understand what had happened. 1 week later, my mother discovered she was pregnant. My parents have been trying for a third child for 2 years by this point, without any luck. They've been close to giving up before receiving the great news. And 9 months later, my little sister, Christine, was born. One knock, one for luck. No one knows exactly who or what the big man is. Clearly, he's not human, because he appears to be immortal and has supernatural powers, or at least the ability to predict the future. Many of our street's residents have expressed theories over the years. The big man has been called everything from an angel, a demon, and a harbinger. Personally, I don't know what he is, but I consider what he does as something akin to public service. For better or for worse, he informs us of our destiny. I have in my possession a secret history of the big man, dating back to his first recorded appearance in 1886. We have written records thanks to the diligent work of the Hennessy family. Mr. Hennessy was our neighbor for decades before his passing from cancer at the age of 73. He carried on the tradition of documenting the big man's appearances, as his father and grandfather had done before him. Thanks to this family's dedication, we'd had a detailed history dating back to year dot, a record of every time that the big man has walked our street, what time he arrived, the houses he visited, and the fates of those who received the dreaded knocks. We don't know why the big man picks our street specifically. No other street in the area has been subjected to such visits. Ours is a back street leading off a main thoroughway, but there's never been any reported sightings of the mysterious figure on this busy road. For all intents and purposes, he appears as if from nowhere at the top of our street before disappearing without a trace when he reaches the end. What's more, for several minutes of his lonely walk, it's as if our street is cut off from the rest of the world, like we've been temporarily transported to another plane of existence. It's a terrifying thing, and perhaps it's best not to think too much about it. He came to us the very first year the street was built and has come every year since. The window knocking I experienced in 1987 is a regular occurrence of his visitations. The number of houses he visits varies year by year, and there's no discernible pattern. Some years he'll stop at several houses, the record for one night is 6, while other times he only calls on one household. And on a couple occasions, he's walked the street without tapping on a single window. However, we know one thing for certain. The fates of the family visited will depend on the number of times the big man taps on their window. 1 for luck, 2 for misfortune, and 3 for death. That's why my parents were so frightened that night, and so relieved that the big man moved on after a single knock. We were blessed that night. But if the man had knocked 1 or, God forbid, 2 more times on our window, well, it doesn't bear thinking about. One knock doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win the lottery, but can mean that someone in your household will pass their exams or get a new job. Likewise, 2 knocks mean anything from an illness or injury, losing one's job, or getting arrested. After my first experience with the big man in 1987, it was another decade before he called on our family again. On that cold autumn night in 1997, we received 2 knocks, and a fortnight later, my daddy suffered a heart attack. It was terrifying, but my father had a successful bypass surgery, after which he changed his lifestyle and made a full recovery. And even though we were all scared, we knew daddy would pull through, because the big man had knocked twice and not 3 times. 3 knocks, meaning there will be a death in the household. We've had some tragedies on the street over the year, everything from undiagnosed illnesses, car crashes, and murder. The big man has never been wrong. That said, 3 knocks isn't always an unwanted visitation. If a resident is old and suffering from a painful and incurable illness, they may very well welcome the prospect of a final release. Nevertheless, 3 knocks is the message that every young family dreads to receive. Well, I can imagine what you're all thinking at this point. No doubt you have questions. Has anyone ever seen the big man in the flesh? Has anyone ever tried to stop him? And why don't you call the police? Try to address these points one by one. Firstly, yes, several people have seen the big man over the decades. Contrary to the beliefs of some, it doesn't do you any harm to look upon the walking figure, although it's recommended you do so from a safe distance and you must never look him in the eye. I'll explain why later. Many people, myself included, have dared to peek through the curtains over the years and have caught a glimpse of the big man, living to tell the tale. How would I describe him? Well, as his name suggests, the big man is incredibly large, almost impossibly so. He's at least 7 foot tall and, if you'll excuse my language, built like a brick shit house. Broad-shouldered and with a huge frame that would dwarf that of any average male adult. His clothing is consistent with the style of the late 19th or early 20th century, and as far as you can tell, hasn't changed in the last 140 years. His head is always covered by a fedora-style hat, and he wears a long trench coat reaching down to his ankles with his collar turned up to cover his face. On his feet are heavy military-type boots, which emit the impossibly loud thumping sound whenever he walks. Other than this, there isn't much to say about the big man's physical appearance. Clearly, he goes to some effort to disguise his true form, and no doubt there's good reason for this. Also, it has proved impossible to photograph or video the big man during his annual visit. Many have tried over the years, but the film is always corrupted. With regard to the police, well, we live in a community where we don't usually involve the authorities, as we prefer to deal things ourselves. Besides, what would we tell the switchboard operator? That there's a 7-foot-tall paranormal entity walking down the street, randomly tapping on people's windows? I think not. Oh, and before you ask, several priests have attempted to carry out exorcisms on our street over the years, but all to no avail. There have, in fact, been 3 recorded occasions during our street's history where persons have attempted to interfere with our visitor as he carries out his rounds. The first occurred in 1891, a few years after the big man had first appeared. A group of local men had grown tired of the big man's visits, and so armed themselves with clubs, bats, and knuckle dusters, intending to run the visitor off the street. Mr. Hennessy's grandfather wrote an account of the event in his journal, describing how the gang of toughs lost their nerve whenever they saw the figure approach, fleeing from the scene and taking refuge inside their homes. It was more than 80 years later before anyone dared to confront the big man again. The year was 1972, and the troubles were at their height. There was a man called Hughes who lived in number 12. He was a member of a paramilitary group whose name I won't mention, and he had a reputation for being a hothead. Anyway, in the run of the 1972 visit, Mr. Hughes had been bragging to his neighbors, saying how he planned to kill the big man once and for all. He was warned against such a rash course of action by many, including Mr. Hennessy's father, but Hughes took no notice. That night, he armed himself with a fully loaded revolver and set up a rather crude trap, removing the front of his letterbox to use as a firing slit. Laying in wait, Hughes stood guard on one knee by his front door and opened fire at point-blank range whenever the big man crossed his doorstep. Now, there's still some debate as to whether the 6 bullets went straight through his huge frame or if the bullets struck his body and simply failed to make any impact. In any event, the big man didn't react at all to the attack. He simply kept on walking. That is, for another 6 yards, at which point he turned to face Mr. Hughes' front window, tapping the glass 3 times. And sure enough, Hughes was shot dead in a gun battle with the army 5 days later. There are those to this day who argue that the big man had punished Hughes for his violent attack. I don't believe this, nor did the late Mr. Hennessy. We believe Mr. Hughes was always marked for death, regardless of the reckless shooting he carried out. Having studied and analyzed the big man's visits over the decades, Mr. Hennessy was unable to identify any obvious pattern or correlation. The big man doesn't appear to reward good people or punish bad ones. Likewise, some households have received multiple visits in the past years, while others haven't had a knock on their window in decades. It all seems so random and not at all subject to an ordained plan. Personally, I don't believe the big man is in any way malicious. In many ways, he's simply a messenger. That's not to say he isn't dangerous to us mere mortals, and the fate of Mr. Johnston attests to this. Mr. Johnston used to live in number 23. He was, I'm sorry to say, an alcoholic. To be fair to him, Mr. Johnston was a functioning alcoholic for much of his adult life, holding down a job and providing for his family. But then one year he received 2 knocks on the front window, and soon after he got laid off by his employer. Mr. Johnston's alcohol problem only worsened after this misfortune. He wasn't able to find a new job, and whatever little money he had was squandered away on drink. Eventually, his wife had enough and moved out, taking their 2 sons with her. Mr. Johnston was rarely sober, and his life was a total shambles. Nevertheless, he wasn't a violent or aggressive drunk, and became more of a nuisance than anything else. He was still a member of our community, however, and all his neighbors chipped in to make sure he was okay, tidying his house, making sure he ate, and running him to A&E whenever he fell over drunk and hurt himself. We tried to get him to sober up and get his act together, but there's not much you could do for a man who lacks the will to change. The year was 1999, and it was coming up to the night of the big man's annual visit. No one had seen Mr. Johnston for a few days, but he had a reputation for going off on lengthy benders, and he always made his way home eventually. We therefore expected him to turn up at some point. I don't think anyone could have imagined the tragedy that befell that poor man on that awful night. The big man came as always, arriving at the top of the street shortly before midnight and walking his route as he always did. Several of the residents, myself included, were nervously watching his progress from behind drawn curtains, quietly praying that we wouldn't receive bad news. All was going to plan, so to speak, until we suddenly heard a loud ruckus emanating from the far end of the street. I remember that moment vividly and can still recall the horror I felt when I saw the inebriated Mr. Johnston staggering along the road, singing an incoherent ballad as he went. Mr. Johnston was drunkenly making his way down the street from one end, while the huge figure of the big man slowly marched from the other direction. If no one intervened, the two would meet in the middle of the street, and God knows what would happen to the poor and hapless Mr. Johnston. I was only 16 at the time, but I still feel guilty to this day that I did nothing to save the poor man. I wanted to open the window and shout out a warning, but I was frozen in terror. In fact, there were at least a dozen residents watching this terrible event unfold, hiding in darkened rooms and peeking through curtains. Not one of them made a move or called out a warning. We were all impotent and helpless observers to the tragedy about to unfold. Mr. Johnston virtually stumbled into the big man, the sight reminding me of a shallow wave breaking against a solid wall of rock. The big man's reaction was extremely unnerving. He did something he'd never done before, stopping dead in his tracks, facing the baffled Mr. Johnston at a distance of only a few short meters. Johnston struggled to stand and focused his eyes on the huge and frightening figure blocking his path. His garbled ballad abruptly ended as he saw his assailant and finally realized the extreme danger he was in, as his drunken stupor was replaced by absolute terror. And then the big man did something he'd never done before. Slowly and precisely, he lowered the collar of his trench coat ever so slightly. From my position, I could see a little, but it was obvious that Mr. Johnston could. From where he stood, he would have been able to stare directly into the big man's face, whatever it was he had under the collar and hat. I'll never forget the look of absolute terror etched across Mr. Johnston's ghostly pale face in that moment. I'd never seen a human being so frightened in all my life. Poor Mr. Johnson remained frozen in place for somewhere between 5 to 10 seconds. He was staring into an abyss, seemingly unable to avert his eyes. And then, all of a sudden, he fell down. His body simply collapsed onto the road as if all the life had been drained out of him. The awful sight reminded me of a puppet suddenly having a string cut all at once. The big man paused for just a moment before carefully readjusting his collar, stepping over Mr. Johnson's lifeless body, and continuing his march down the road. Thump, thump, thump. Mercifully, no one received a knock on the window that night, but the damage had already been done. Nobody dared to step onto the street until we already knew he was gone. By the time we went to Mr. Johnson's aid, it was already too late. The paramedic said he'd suffered a massive heart attack and died instantly. Naturally, we didn't tell him what really happened that night, but given Mr. Johnson's history of substance abuse, the authorities didn't ask too many questions, and his death was written off as due to natural causes. But everyone on our street knew that nothing natural had happened on that awful evening, and no one ever spoke of confronting the big man again. And so life went on. The big man continued to make his visit once a year. The night is always tense and nerve-wracking, but for better or worse, we've always got through it. His visits are like the weather, sometimes good and other times bad, but there's no way to change it. So the residents of Arden Street have simply learned to deal with this unique and unexplainable annual occurrence. So I'd be asking why I've decided to break our code of silence after all these decades. Why am I speaking out now and telling people about something that only affects our wee street? Well, that's just the thing. It isn't just about Arden Street anymore. And after what happened during the big man's last visit, I believe the time has come for the world to know the truth. Before I describe to you the events of the fateful night last autumn, I think it's worth telling you more about myself and how my life has turned out. I'm in my late 30s now and have been married for 16 years to my husband, Stephen. Steve is a local boy, but he didn't grow up on our street, so he had no previous knowledge of the big man or his annual visits. Stevie didn't believe me when I first told him of our bizarre tradition. He assumed I was playing a joke on him. But after he saw for himself, he never questioned me again. We've had a happy marriage, all in all. There's been ups and downs like any relationship, but for the most part, it's been good. My parents retired to a bungalow up on the North Coast while Stevie and I took on the house, soon starting a family of our own. We've been blessed with two wonderful children, our eldest Tom, now age 15, and our daughter Jenny, age 12. We're not a wealthy family, but we make it do, and we live in a very supportive community. I love my family and my neighbors, and I count myself very lucky to have them in my life. The other thing to say about myself is that I've inherited the task of recording the big man's annual visits to our wee street, taking over the job for Mr. Hennessy after he passed away. Mr. Hennessy was our neighbor for decades, and he and his wife were like family to us. I became particularly close to Mr. Hennessy after his wife passed away. The couple had never had children, so he was lonely after losing his wife, and I felt it was my responsibility to look after him. Then, in 2015, the poor man received 3 knocks on his window from the big man, and soon after he was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. I was devastated upon hearing this, but Mr. Hennessy took the bad news philosophically, saying he'd lived a good life, but now his time had come. He did, however, ask for one last favor for me before he passed away. He wanted me to continue his family's legacy and take on responsibility for me recording the big man's annual visits. I was reluctant, to be honest. This task was more of a burden than an honor, but I didn't feel like I could refuse Mr. Hennessy's dying request, and so I said yes. As I said, life went on. I raised my family and recorded the unique history of our street, adding to the Hennessy family journal year by year. Thankfully, my own family didn't receive any visits for several years. That was until last autumn. Like my first encounter with the big man back in 1987, last year's visit was an early one, coming shortly after dusk. We're all sitting up together in the living room, Stevie and I watching TV, while Tom and Jenny are playing with their smartphones. As always, we were all slightly nervous, but the kids are old enough now to know the score. I felt comfortable that we could get through anything that came, as long as we stuck together as a family. The streetlights flickered off and on 3 times, just after 7, prompting my son Tom to swear aloud. "Oh shit," he exclaimed. "Mind your language, young man," I reprimanded. "He's bloody early this year," my husband added nervously. "It's not a no," I replied, whilst trying to exert confidence in my voice. "He's come early before, and it makes no difference to how things turn out." This much was true, but nevertheless, I felt uneasy. Couldn't stop myself thinking back to that night in 87, when I was a terrified little girl quaking in my daddy's arms. But now I had my own family to protect, and so I needed to stay strong. Before long, we heard the ominous sound of the big man's heavy boots thumping forcefully against the pavement. Thump, thump, thump. We went through our usual routine, quickly drawing the curtains and switching off all lights and electrical devices, sitting silently in the dark as we waited for our visitor to pass. thump, thump, thump. The sound gradually grew ever louder. Before long, the dark shadow of his huge frame would pass by our front windows. I quietly prayed he would leave us be. The odds were we'd be fine, but you could never know. And suddenly there he was, the giant figure blocking out the lights from the street, his ominous silhouette clearly visible through our thin curtains. My daughter Jenny gasped in awe and terror. I grabbed hold of her, holding a hand up to her mouth and telling her to keep quiet. But to my horror, I saw the big man had stopped dead in his tracks, and I watched him slowly turn to face our window. Sweet Jesus, Stevie swore under his breath. I looked at the face of my children and saw their fear. It's going to be okay, kids. Stay brave, I said. I didn't want to show my kids how scared I truly was. We waited breathlessly, waiting on a terrace. The big man lifted his enormous arm, forming a solid fist and reaching out to knock on the glass. Bang! Felt my whole body tremble as the ominous sound reverberated throughout our small living room. One knock, one for luck. Would my family be lucky once again? Somehow I doubted it. Bang! The second knock, two for misfortune. Jenny started to sob softly. I held her hand so tightly. We can survive this, I remember thinking. Whatever life throws at us, we can get through it, just as long as... Bang! The third knock. Three for death. Please, God, no, I swore, as I felt a sickness rising from the pit of my stomach. In a panic, I glanced across at Stevie and saw the shocked horror in his eyes. We talked about this nightmare scenario once before, praying that, if worse came to worse, death would take one of us. The thought of losing one of the children was too terrible to contemplate. I was still reeling from the terrifying implications when I heard it. Bang. A fourth knock. I was in a state of utter shock. How could this be possible? Had I miscounted? Four knocks, Tom confirmed, as if reading my mind. There's something evident in my son's eyes that I should have picked up on, but I was too distracted. Four knocks. This has never happened before, not in a century and a half of our street's history. My mind was racing in that moment. What could this mean? What horrific outcome could four knocks signify? A fate worse than death itself? Whatever it meant, we'd have to work it out for ourselves, as the big man turned back towards the pavement and continued his walk down the street. It would have ended there, I suppose, but what happened next took me completely off guard. Now, my Tom has always worn his heart on his sleeve. He's got a good heart and cares about his family and friends. If he gets in a fight at school, it's usually because he's defending some other kid from bullies. That said, he's an impulsive teenager, prone to acting without thinking of the consequences, and this is exactly what happened that night. It all happened so fast, before either Stevie or I had a chance to intervene. Tom obviously saw red, letting his emotions get the better of him. In an instant, he was up on his feet and sprinting out the living room, heading straight for our front door. Jenny was the first to react. She broke from my embrace, screaming, "Tom, don't do it!" Before I could stop her, Jenny had taken off after her brother. Stevie and I jumped up and chased after our children, screaming at them to come back, but it was already too late. I ran out to the corridor and, to my horror, saw Tom open the front door and charge out onto the street. Jenny meant to follow her brother, but Stevie acted quickly, physically grabbing our daughter and holding her back while she kicked and screamed wildly. Without thinking, I pushed past them and dashed out onto the pavement. This was an action I never thought I would take on the night of visitation, but my son's life was in danger, and so I had no choice. I came onto the road to witness a horrifying scene. My son's anger had not diminished, as he stood behind the big man and screamed out at the top of his lungs, "What the fuck do you want from us? Why can't you leave us alone?" For a short time, it seemed as if the whole world stood still. To my abject horror, I saw the giant figure of the big man stop in his tracks and slowly begin to turn in Tom's direction. In that moment, I couldn't help but remember what happened to Mr. Johnson all those years ago. I wasn't going to let the same fate befall my son. I was determined to save him, even if it meant sacrificing myself to do so. In an instant, I sprinted across the road and threw myself on top of Tom, tackling my son down to the hard ground. He yelped in shock and pain, but I lay on top of him, frantically whispering in his ear, saying, "Stay down. Whatever you do, don't look at his face." We both trembled in each other's arms as we lay on the cold tarmac, quietly praying for our salvation. I heard Stevie shouting my name from the doorway. "Stay where you are," I cried back without looking up. All was silent for the next few minutes, and then we heard it. Thump, thump, thump. I glanced up ever so slightly and was horrified to see the foreboding figure slowly walking back towards us. Walking back, retracing his step. This had never happened, not in 140 years. The big man had always walked from one end of the street to the other, never had he marched the other way, until now. I didn't dare look up and was unable to move an inch, instead simply clutching hold of my son as I sought to protect him from what was coming. Tom was openly sobbing by this point, as his previous bravado had faded away. I silently cursed him for putting us in such a severe situation, but this was no time for recriminations. Thump, thump, thump. The big man was almost on top of us now, his heavy black boots only inches from my head. A terrible stench emanated from underneath his trench coat. It smelled like death. The terror I felt in that moment was unlike any I'd previously experienced. I didn't just fear for my life, but also for my soul. But despite everything else, my maternal instinct remained strong. "Don't look up," I whispered to the whimpering Tom. He stood over us for what seemed like an eternity. I never had predicted what happened next. For the first time in recorded history, the big man spoke. His voice was deep and booming, more godlike than any sound a human could emit. And what he said was this: "It is coming. You must prepare them." And with that, he turned on his heels and began to walk down in the opposite direction, slowly progressing until he reached the end of the street and disappeared into thin air. Tom and I survived that horrendous night, but our entire family was left traumatized by those bizarre and unprecedented events, as were the other neighbors of our street. Several months have passed, and so far no terrible fate has befallen our family, although we still live in fear. I've spent countless hours and sleepless nights trying to make sense that night. The four knocks, the big man's cryptic words. What is coming? Who must we prepare? I don't know for sure, but I think this is bigger than me, bigger than us. I believe whatever catastrophe the big man had warned us of is something that will affect society as a whole, and not just our low back street. This is why I'm going public. I need to get this information out there. I don't know what is coming or what we must do to prepare, but I pray someone out there does, because I fear we're fast running out of time. And...
damn.
Damn.
That was a good one.
You know, I've had that written down since January, and for some reason I thought it ended on three knocks and like and nine and fourth, and even I was a little surprised. I was like, what does that mean again?
All right. So my last story is titled My Grandfather's Final Invention, and it is by Alice Thompson. My grandfather was an inventor. All his life he's been tinkering with something. Either taking something that existed and changing it, or making it into something brand new, or at the very least, different. Or inventing something entirely from spare parts. And while nothing he invented was ever earth-shaking, it was always one of my greatest delights, ever since I was a little girl, to see what he'd made. Childhood visits to his home would always begin or end with me sitting on the couch, a look of absolute fascination on my tiny face as he showed off whatever gadget he'd put together in his workshop this time around. It was like having my own personal Santa who worked all year round to fill my 8-year-old mind with wonder and glee. My older sister was likewise excited. No matter how much she tried to hide the excitement it filled her with, probably in an effort to appear cooler or more mature than myself. And while, because of real life getting in the way, the visits became fewer and fewer the older we got, we would always make time to see him at least a few times a year. And every time, he would have something new to show us. He really was a genius. I should add that it isn't meant to imply something horrible happened to him. I'm sure some days he wishes it had, and that it had been him who wound up in the hospital instead of my sister. But no, he went in his sleep, and I hope his passing was a peaceful one. Even after all these years later, I can't bring myself to be angry about what happened. I can't bring myself to hate him. He had no idea what would happen, no clue how things would pan out. He knew something was wrong. Oh yes, he wasn't some doddering old fool. He knew the first time he looked through them that something was wrong. He thought it was something only a little odd, something unsettling and curious perhaps, but not anything dangerous, not anything that would harm anyone. I think deep down he just wanted to know that he wasn't crazy. He wanted to be sure that he wasn't seeing things. And who can he blame? There were three of us that year. Myself and my girlfriend Justine. Gay.
Gay.
Myself and my sister Justine and my sister Joan. We were both used to our grandfather being bursting with energy, excited to show us what he put together. His mood was odd that day. When he came to the door to greet us, it came as a bit of a surprise. I was a little disappointed, in fact, as I'd been hoping Justine would get to share in the experience of having a new invention demonstrated before our awestruck eyes. We'd only started dating that year, so it would be the first chance she got to see the kind of things I'd been telling her about. The day passed pleasantly enough as we chatted, enjoyed lunch, and watched television together. I think it was Joan who asked him, finally, if he had anything special to show us today. We knew that he'd been working on something, as while this was the first time we'd seen him in person in a while, and we'd both spoken to him on the phone in the preceding months, and he'd eagerly explained to us what he was working on, something he thought would be quite extraordinary. I still couldn't tell you how he made them, nor would I if I could. Nor could I tell you what his original idea for those oddly colored circles of glass had been. Before that fateful day, he'd looked through them and seen what he'd seen. He never shared the details of his work with us beforehand, as he wanted it to be a surprise, and afterwards, I think he was terrified of the thought of anyone replicating what he made. All I know is that when Joan pressed him to reveal his latest invention, he looked nervous in a way I'd never seen him before. Looked as if he was deeply troubled by something. He hesitated before speaking, as if not sure he should say anything at all before explaining to us the nature of what he was working on had changed after an unusual event, and that he wasn't sure it would be a good idea to show us the end result. Now, we may have grown since the days when we could perch on his knee, but whether someone is 2 years old or in their 20s, the surest way to make them want something all the more is to tell them they can't have it. So his reluctance, which at the time I'm sure we both thought was fake, so heightened the suspense before the unveiling. Just made us both want to see his invention even more. With little persuading, he agreed and left to fetch it. He came back a few moments later with what appeared to be a pair of glasses, with one big difference. The lenses were like no glass we'd ever seen before. I can't even describe the color of it without resorting to words like reddish or greeny, as they didn't seem to be exactly any color that we have a name for. In fact, they didn't seem to be exactly any one color at all, as if you tilted them one way, they would look different, and if you tilted them another. I know full well that probably sounds more like magic than something a well-meaning old man could put together in his humble little workshop, but there you have it. Joan asked what they did, and our grandfather paused for a few moments, as if not quite certain how to answer. In the end, he told us that we really had to put them on for ourselves, as he was certain neither of us would believe him if he told us. Joan wanted to put them on first, but as she lifted them off the table, he reached out and grabbed her hand. He cautioned her that it might be startling at first, but that she wasn't in any danger, and that if she got frightened, she could just take them off. He warned her that what she was about to see may not make any more sense to her than it did to him, but that we were all there and that she was safe. I could tell Joan was a little frightened. She always was lousy at hiding how she felt from people. Even I was feeling a bit unsettled by her grandfather being so unlike himself about the whole thing. Joan slipped the glasses on, and we waited. She gasped. Then for the next few moments, she looked puzzled more than anything. Her lips moved wordlessly, and I thought I caught a "no, that's not right" under her breath as she seemed to look around at something none of us could see. And then she began screaming. I don't know if you have ever really heard someone scream in horror in real life. I can promise you this. It's not like in the movies. The movies do not convey the awful sound of someone you love screaming their lungs out, making a noise more like an animal than a human being. They cannot make you feel the things I felt in that moment, watching Joan yank the glasses from her head and hurl them across the room. And nothing could have prepared us for the sight of Joan beginning to claw her eyes, her own eyes, screaming louder than anyone should be able to scream as she did. It took all three of us to restrain her at first. When we had her pinned down so she couldn't hurt herself anymore, Justine and my grandfather held her, that way I could call for an ambulance. I had to watch as she was strapped down and wheeled into the back of one, thrashing and hissing and shrinking like some mad animal, like something utterly consumed by fear. I explained what had happened, knowing full well how it made me sound. Justine and I both explained the series of events that led to this, to the skeptical, if not totally disbelieving, hospital staff, and then to the specialist called in when nothing short of being tranquilized proved effective at stopping my sister from trying to hurt herself while screaming like that. The glasses had supposedly gone missing, which made proving what had happened difficult. And it wasn't until almost a year later, long after my sister had been committed, that my grandfather finally confessed to me that he had destroyed them. I don't know if having them could have helped, could have given the doctors some way of to make things right. I doubt it somehow, and I can't truly blame him for doing what he did, given that it was an act born out of guilt and an honest desire to make sure this didn't happen again. I asked him what my sister had seen that day, when he told me what he'd done. I asked what those glasses had done to her. He hadn't wanted to talk about it. For the first time in my life, I'd raised my voice at him, angrily demanding to know, after all this time, just what had driven my sister to this state. What had affected her so deeply, so profoundly, that she was now no longer even recognizable as the person I had grown up with. He took me to his workshop and began digging around through the bits and pieces that littered the place, the half-finished and now long-discarded inventions still awaiting completion. He produced two pieces of glass, rather like the ones that had been fitted into those glasses. He told me there wasn't any way to describe it without sounding insane, that if I had to know, then I had to see. But he begged me not to do this, knowing wouldn't make things any better. He was right. I held the glass up to my eyes, and in an instant, everything changed. Instead of just my grandfather stood before me now, there was dozens more in the room with us, but they weren't people. They were pale and emaciated, hunched over, and dressed in dark clothing with black lips and wide, lidless eyes that seemed to almost bulge from their skulls, in a manner both comical and horrifying all at once. Their mouths were full of hundreds of thin teeth, like needles. Their fingers were grotesquely long and ended in dark, viciously pointed nails that scraped along the floor as they walked. That's some long-ass nails.
Yeah, no thank you.
All of them were talking, or rather, their lips were moving soundlessly. Each and every one of them was trying to say something that couldn't be heard. Dozens upon dozens of voices trying to convey something. I dropped the glasses to the ground in shock, and my grandfather brought his foot down hard on them, grinding them to powder beneath his foot, muttering that he shouldn't have done this in the first place. He put an arm on my shoulder, asking if I was alright. I was far from alright. He had been correct. What I had seen made things worse, not better. It took me a while to work it out, of course, why this had such a horrifying effect on my sister, and yet I had survived the experience. frightened, but not sporting the mental scars it had given her. The glasses only let me see the creatures. I couldn't hear what they were trying to say to me. Couldn't understand the message they were trying to impart. But my sister was deaf. She could read their lips.
What the fuck?
Yep. I was like, oh. So I don't know what they said, but it was spooky as fuck.
Enough to make somebody have a fucking breakdown.
Yeah.
I like that one.
But yeah.
All right. Our final story today is going to be We're All a Little Weird by Sam Gallenberger. This shit always happens. First no service and now no food, Teresa said, brow furrowed and pointing across the campfire before burying her face into her hands. It's not my fault, I swear, David yelled, raising his arms with his palms facing forward. I know this looks bad, but I promise I packed everything. Yeah, okay, Davy boy, whatever you say, Mason replied. He turned his head and looked over towards the lake. The moon was full tonight, its bright beams illuminating the lake in awe-inspiring fashion. Like, what are we going to do now? Asked Laura. I have a few ideas, Jason said, putting his arm around Davina and pulling her close. Oh, Jason, predictable as ever. The eight of us were out camping, and the ever-forgetful David had left most of the food at home. Way out in this neck of the woods, we would have to wait until morning to restock. We left a few bottles of vodka, a bottle of whiskey, 2 24-packs of beer, and 1 gallon of water for the 7 of us. Not exactly ideal conditions for a bunch of 20-somethings looking to enjoy the long weekend without dying. Shots it is, Mason mumbled. I have an idea. Why don't we play a game, said Tim. Jason spoke up. Sounds better than telling each other shitty campfire stories, I'll tell you that much. Tell us about the game, Timmy. It's called We're All a Little Weird, he said. Gotta be kidding me, I replied. This is where our trip has come to? What the hell's that? Why don't we play Throw David in the River instead? David looked at the rest of us. On the surface, it looked like most were in agreement. He scooted his seat a little further back than the rest of us. Seriously, though, it's a fun game. You guys in? We literally have nothing better to do. Might as well, Teresa replied. Great. The rules are as follows. We start by choosing a moderator, starting with a moderator, and then going around the circle. Each of us will tell an embarrassing or messed up story about ourselves. You end each story by saying we're all a little weird. If you don't, you drink. If someone thinks the story isn't creepy or embarrassing enough, it's up to the moderator to decide to take a vote. If a vote is taken and the majority agrees, the person will have to drink and tell another story, he said. That's basically what I just said I don't want to do, damn it, Jason replied. There's a little more to it. One of the ways to get around is by lying. But if you get caught in a lie and can't prove you're telling the truth, you must do the thing you lied about. The moderator has discretion here, of course. The mod determines it's unfair, same deal, drink and start over. Actually, this sounds great, Jason said. The rest of the group reluctantly agreed. Okay, since I'm the one who's played this before, is everyone cool with me being the moderator? Tim asked. Go for it, Teresa said. No issues here, I replied, puffing on a cig. Yeah, you're good, chimed in Mason. Okay, I'll start. I once called a friend and he didn't pick up. This was back in the flip phone days when you actually had to try and remember numbers. So I left a voicemail about how hot I found his mom. Turns out I'd gotten 1 digit wrong on the number and left it on her phone. We're all a little weird, Tim said. Oh my god, Tim, Laura laughed. You poor thing, Davina replied. Yeah, it wasn't great. All right, Jason, you're up, Tim said. Gladly. Davina and I hooked up in front of everyone here. We're all a little weird, he said, grinning. That definitely never happened, Teresa said. Oh no, I guess I lied. Bummer. I guess we have to do it now, he replied. Yeah, no, mod discretion. Drink and go again, Tim said. Jason shot him a look. He grabbed the nearest bottle and took a big swig. Fine, be that way. One time I shit myself in the pool, blamed on someone else, and still got caught. We're all a little weird. You're up, Davina. I like that story a lot better, I said, laughing. Go ahead, Davina. I like masturbating in my car. One time someone caught me. We're all a little weird, she said, blushing. Calm down, Jason, I said. I didn't even say anything. Doesn't matter, we can sense your excitement, I replied. David began to go. Okay, you guys won't believe me, but I swear I saw a spaceship in the sky a few weeks back. I have the picture to prove it. We're all a little weird, he said. How do you know it's a spaceship? Davina asked. I saw a circle of lights in the sky. Let me guess, you were downtown, Jason asked, grabbing David's phone, then peering at the image. Yeah, how'd you know? David responded. Those are casino lights, you dumbass. Does this even count as a turn? I'll allow it. That's honestly pretty embarrassing, Tim said. We all started cracking up. Most of the early stories were silly and innocent. There was a lot of drinking early on. As we got some of the alcohol in us, the stories began getting weirder. It was David's turn again. I have a teeth collection. I used to get all the neighbor kids' baby teeth, and then it just kind of expanded from there. We're all a little weird. It's so gross. Teresa, please go. I don't want to think about this any longer, Laura said. Okay, she's starting to stir a little bit. A year or so ago, I was seeing this guy. One time we were hooking up, and I kind of instinctively bit his ear. It must have been too into the moment, because I took a chunk out of it and ended up swallowing it. We're all a little weird, she said. Barf, by the way. Bullshit, Jason said. Prove it. I can't, she replied. Then you have to do it, Tim said. No, guys, come on. Seriously, who would I even? She said, looking at Jason. Those are the rules. I'll volunteer, but you have to sit in my lap when you do it, Jason said, smirking. Teresa covered her face with her hands. Jesus, how drunk are you two? Mason asked. What is even happening right now? Laura said. Maybe we should, like, stop. What else do we have to do? Not like we have food, working phones, or the ability to drive right now, Tim asked. I can't believe this, Teresa sighed. She climbed on Jason's lap, got close, and started nibbling his ear. Stop, Jason yelled. I believe you. We're good. We all looked at Tim. Do we all believe her? Everyone is in agreement. Then I'll allow it. Teresa quietly returned back to her seat. Her face was beet red. I'm so glad that didn't actually just happen, David said. Mason, go, Davina said, her head looking the other way. Guess I'm up. Someone really pissed me off one time, so I snuck into the place late at night and painted I'm watching you in red on their walls. We're all a little weird, Mason said. Wow, that's pretty fucked up, Mason. You've got to be lying, David said. Mason pulled out his phone and showed us all the picture. There he was in a room with red paint lettering behind him. I guess I was wrong, David mumbled. Laura was next in the circle. Remember that guy Sean from school? Well, he was a creep. He'd been stalking me and wouldn't leave me alone for days, so I falsely accused him of sexual assault. We're all a little weird. What the fuck, Laura? Are you serious? Jason asked, putting some gauze on his ear. She wasn't looking any of us in the eyes. Jesus, that's messed up, Mason said. He passed me another beer. Look, the authorities wouldn't do anything. I didn't know what to do, she replied, taking another swig of their drink. I know it's bad, but who knows what he would have done to me if I didn't. These were getting personal. Let's just move on, I said, pausing for a moment. Did I really want to tell this story? Oh, what the hell? I have some liquid courage in me. I'm up anyway. My brother and I were messing around downtown and playing with my lighter. A trick didn't go exactly as planned, and I accidentally set an abandoned building in town on fire. We're all a little weird. That was you? Didn't somebody die? Therese asked. I gently nodded. I was playing with the lighter, and before I knew it, the fire had spiraled out of control and we ran. I found out later a homeless guy was staying there and hadn't made it out. I'd buried it inside ever since. I don't even know what to think, David said. Me either, Laura replied. No kidding, I'm shook, Jason said. I ducked my head. The crackling of the fire was the only sound made within the circle. Can't believe I just told them that. We're getting pretty drunk if I was telling this story. Even my vision was starting to go. Tim was up. Looks like people are getting pretty out of it, so I'll wrap this up. I've been planning this trip for months, and it's lived up to the hype. You guys really are a bunch of weirdos. Now that I've spiked all your drinks, it's about time I get down to business. I'm going to kill you all. We're all a little weird.
I lost my microphone for a second, but damn!
Because if he hasn't killed them, now he has to do it to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, what a... The stories? I bit off a guy's ear. I'm like, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's weird.
We're all a little weird. Mm, yeah.
That weird.
That's it for my stories.
Damn.
Okay. Well, did you have anything you wanted to add before we end this episode?
No, thank you for listening.
Thank you. If you guys want to email us any episode ideas, you can at thespookyshit.pod@gmail.com. Our Twitter and Instagram are spookyshit_pod, and our website is spookyshit-pod.com. Thank you all for listening. We're all a little weird. And catch you guys next week. Goodbye.
Bye.